because I would defend him to no end. I mean, I was willing to lose anything to this. So once he was mine and he said, let's be boyfriend and girlfriend, that is the point where I could not pull away. I would say the hope of what I thought he could be or what he would always promise me was just about to come next. Hope was a chain I could not break. So I was already at the point where I was like, I have got to leave this guy. This time has to be it right now. I was already at that point, like, probably like 2 years before I married him. Leaving my ex was such a painful thing that it honestly felt like death.
Welcome to the Let Me Tell You podcast, a podcast where people share their experiences of trial and heartache in order to bring comfort, hope, and inspiration to others. My guest today is actually a host of her own podcast called Why She Stayed. And it's one that I got into, I mean, probably over the last year, if not longer, as I got into these relationships, these learning about narcissism and abusive relationships and wanting to hear more stories from women who'd been through it and to understand why they don't just leave. So this is Grace. Grace, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited. And I love your podcast, and it's so great. I had you as a guest, and now I'm on here, so it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. So for anyone who doesn't know, I was not in an abusive relationship, but I like to use my platform or have used my platform to help people understand why people don't get out of these relationships, how they operate, and how hard they are to actually get out of. And some of the red flags to look out for so you don't end up in one of them. And so Grace had me on to talk about some of those things, especially if you're helping someone who is in one of those relationships. Today is Grace's turn to tell her own story on our podcast. And I wanted to start because listening to your episode again, going over it and refreshing, the first thing that jumped out to me was there is a pretty big age gap between you and your ex. So can you talk about that age gap and how you think that influenced the relationship?
Absolutely. So when I first met him, I had just turned 20, I believe, and we had a 14-year age gap. So he was much older than me always. And I met him at the gym where I was going. He was a trainer there. So that's like a first red flag. Oh, meeting some guy at the gym. Like everybody always says that. But it just happens. And anybody who's been in that situation knows how you just start bantering with someone, you start talking regularly, and one thing leads to another. And I think I was at a place in life too, where of course, number one, I was young, but also number two, I was just kind of not really sure of what direction I was going in. Maybe a little insecure at the time. However, I meet so many survivors who they were fully self-confident and fully secure in themselves when they met their abuser. And unfortunately, these people sometimes take pleasure out of meeting someone like that and then breaking them down slowly. So it really doesn't have too much bearing on finding yourself in an abusive relationship. But I think I was on some shaky ground personally. So I slipped into it very quickly. I started hanging out with him. And I was really also, I talk about my faith a lot on my podcasts and on my page. And I was not very strong in my faith at the time. I was just like, clearly, this is not the guy that God has for me. But nonetheless, fell into it. So that's what happens. And we started talking, but he was, at the time, he had a lot of different women in his life, and I was kind of just that person on the side, which again, more evidence of a situation I shouldn't have been in, but that actually fed into the trauma bond, feeling like I wasn't his number one, and it created a situation where it was, I would call it like a situationship, and I really hate that word. I really do not like it, but for the purpose of setting the scene, that's what it was for like a solid year or more. I was just in and out of his life, and he had a drug problem, which I will talk about throughout this episode, but I knew about his drug problem, but I had no idea what that world was even about. So I just thought, hey, I'm hanging out with a guy who's kind of erratic, he's got addictions, but it never ever crossed my mind that he was abusive. I didn't even know what abuse was at the time. So I thought, I'm with this guy who he has so much potential to be incredible, and never ever crossed my mind that he was a violent person or someone who just like mistreated women. I thought he was a good guy who's just into some bad things.
You know, it's funny. You talked about when you just started bantering back and forth with them and then spending time with them, and it was the situationship, not even a real relationship. I remember my mom telling me when I was about that age, she's like, you can fall in love with anyone that you spend enough time with. If you spend enough time with them, you can fall in love with anyone. That does not mean it's meant to be. That does not mean they're right for you. It just means that's how that happens. You spend more time, more and more time with someone, which is part of why you and I and other people talk about the red flags to notice right off the bat. So you don't end up spending more time with someone and, you know, getting more ingrained into their world and their life and the relationship with.
Exactly. And one thing I want to mention is, since I wasn't his fixation at first, since there were other women, he was still going back to see his ex, and just really made me feel like I had that second place while he just did whatever he wanted. I didn't realize he was controlling since I wasn't his focal point. And at the time, I remember that almost felt offensive to me, that he would come back and say he really wanted to be with me, but then he wasn't really possessive of me or controlling of me within that first year. So I kind of perceived that as that he was the prize, and somehow I needed to live up to get him. Like, he really had a way of positioning himself that way. And the fact that he still acted possessive of his ex-girlfriend, who he was abusive to, but again, I didn't realize that. I thought, I was so hurt by that, that he didn't act that way towards me. And I think a lot of survivors deal with that, those confusing feelings of like, well, why am I not his number one? And situations where there's a lot of triangulation, that was us for a long time before I was ever really his girlfriend. So,
You know, another thing that I hear a lot with a lot, I will say younger girls just don't have a ton of dating experience, maybe, or relationship experience, is they mistake the jealousy for love, he is so into me because he gets jealous when I go talk to other people. They think that's a good thing. And I'm like, no, that's not a good thing.
Yeah, since there was a total absence of that in the first half of our relationship, that actually increased once I was his girl, and once he called me his girlfriend, then I couldn't get out of it from that point forward because it took me on such a high, like, oh my gosh, I'm his girl now. Like, I never thought this would happen. And this sounds pathetic saying it, but I am brutally honest with people, because that's, situationships are often way more hard to get out of than sometimes when you've been with someone a long time because of that intense feeling of not being chosen by them. But some other red flags in the beginning, I would say one of the first red flags is he would really like manhandle me a lot. So he was always very touchy, but in a way that was coercive, and just always like hurting me subtly, putting his hands on me, like pinching, prodding, poking. He would always like shove his body weight into me. And I remember feeling like he was so just invasive, but I couldn't put my finger on why does this feel weird? He always had to be overpowering me somehow. So that was one red flag. Another one is he would often push my boundaries, and then if I didn't do what he wanted sexually, he would then act depressed and he would go and sleep all day at his place. Like if I didn't do what he wanted, he would act like I was hurting him. But at the same time, he would claim that he was on the same page as me at the pace that we were taking things. It's like saying verbally, yeah, I'm in agreement on us not being intimate right now, but then pushing that boundary line, and then the punishment follows. So the reason that's actually coercion is because when some kind of outcome follows, like he goes and acts depressed and sad and puts his pillow over his face, what that does is it communicates to you, oh, it's not worth it to not cave into his boundaries because there's some kind of unpleasant outcome at the end of that.
That's definitely one thing that we've talked about. And I talked about in the red flags, where they don't actually have to control you. The control isn't always, you can't go do this. I will not let you go do this, or I don't want you to go to see them or be with them, see your friends, whatever. It's not always that. Sometimes it's fine, go. If you want to go, fine, go. You go, and then there's a punishment.
Yeah, so once he was mine and he said, let's be boyfriend and girlfriend, that is the point where I could not pull away because now I have the thing that I thought would never be possible. It was almost like I was trying to manifest it. And I don't really believe in manifestation and stuff. Like, everybody's different with that. But I truly felt like I was like speaking it into existence, just trying to make this become something so much. And so once we started dating, I kept it a secret from my parents completely for like an entire summer, I would say. I kept it a secret because it was a control mechanism for me. Now that I had the thing I finally wanted, I was going to make sure nobody could touch it. Nobody could say anything bad about it. And subconsciously, I already knew before he ever started really saying specific controlling things to me, I already knew he was a man who was easily offended. Like, I could tell he was a man that if I did any one thing that seemed sketchy, he was going to be very accusatory. And like, I always had to prove myself. So I knew if my family members started fussing about our relationship, I knew that he was going to somehow use that against me. So I kept everybody very far. Nobody's going to touch this relationship. And it was really hard to maintain that.
Okay, I have to ask at this point then, you're doing that. You know you're doing it subconsciously. You know what you're doing. Were you thinking in your mind, at some point down the road, this is going to be good and then I can bring the people in? Did you ever really think that?
Well, I thought if I just get our relationship to a point where him and I are on really solid ground and we've just been together for so long, I thought then even if my parents start fussing about it or friends start saying bad things, then him and I will be so solid that he won't run in the other direction. Because I always had the sense that he would just like run away if things got hard. Like, I was always one inch away from losing the relationship. And that has to do with he posed as if he was willing to walk away from things many times, but it was actually the opposite. So if I didn't want to have sex or do something, it was like, well, let's just forget the whole thing then. But then if I agreed and said, you know what, maybe you're right, maybe this just isn't going to work. Because there were times where I would I knew it was the wrong situation, so I would kind of try to pull away. But then I realized it was just for show. He would do these little intermittent discards just to make me fear, like I could always lose the relationship at any time. So it's actually a control tactic. It's not that he is willing to just like walk away.
Yeah, no, I think it's just so interesting because I think that we go back to the potential. You saw potential. You saw what this could be. And that's another thing that anyone who's been in your situation will tell a young girl or someone dating, like, we're not focusing on potential right here. We're focusing on what you see today. What are you getting back from this person? What are you seeing from this person? We're dealing with realistic expectations here, not potential, because potential is what you think they're capable of. That does not mean they are capable of that.
And I always say, like, I saw this online, that hope was a chain I couldn't break. I would say the hope of what I thought he could be or what he would always promise me was just about to come next. Hope was a chain I could not break. If there was an absence of hope or he wasn't as good at apologizing as he was, I think I would have been able to break away. But since he was a master at apologizing and promising me, dangling that carrot, saying things are just about to be better, that's why I couldn't get out of it. And what really happened, I really thought that he was just an addict. It created this dynamic of like us against the problem instead of him being the problem. I thought that it was us against his addiction instead of him being a controlling man. So that was really hard.
Oh, there was something that you just said that it flew out of my brain.
So I was saying that hope was a chain that I couldn't break. And if he wasn't so good at apologizing, I would have been able to get out sooner.
That's what it was. People talk so much, especially when you're talking about narcissists specifically. They don't apologize. They can't take accountability for their actions. That's true. They apologize all the time. They don't mean it. They are using it. It's a tactic to keep you. It's a tactic to get you back. That's where the apologies come in. And I always say, watch the action. We're not listening to words anymore. Watch the actions. Are there changes after the apology? Or is it just the apology and then we go back to how it was
before? Right. Another big red flag is he would always talk about God in this really grandiose way. So, and not everybody listening might be a person of faith at all, but I come in contact with many women who their abuser poses to be a man of faith. But I would say to that person, look for the way he really speaks, because my ex used to be like really into like conspiracy theories, and everything about God in his life was very just like blown up. Like he wouldn't just read the scriptures and really let it like impact him. It was more like him trying to just cherry pick things for his advantage. So look for that erratic behavior where everything is very grandiose talking and not just like true humility. That's one thing I wish I realized sooner, because he was like just a fake at the time, basically.
Yeah. And I'm sure you'll get into it, but I know that there is a spiritual abuse. There is where they weaponize scripture, they weaponize religion, they weaponize God to get what they want. And it happens all the time. And it happens in pretty much any faith, any religion. You'll see it across the board, because these guys they'll weaponize anything. They'll weaponize religion, therapy speak. They'll weaponize their own children. They'll weaponize whatever they can to keep you or to get you.
So then as the relationship continued on, I started to notice that everything he would joke about would come true in some form of another. He would just say things to me in jest and casual way that actually he meant. And one of the things was coercing me into his drug use. So keep in mind, there were long periods of time when he would be sober for sometimes 6 months. I mean, 3 months, 6 months, he'd be completely sober and really just like committing to the things that he said. So that's what keeps you involved in the relationship. That is the glue that holds it together. If him and I didn't have good times, inside jokes, I mean, they're the person you talk to all day, every day. Good morning, good night. You tell everything about your job to him. They become ingrained. So there were probably a larger percentage of times that we had good times together. However, he would occasionally relapse, and he was addicted to crack cocaine, which is obviously really extreme. This was after lots of promise making. He's going to be sober for good. So every time this would happen, it was like devastating when he would go smoke crack. And the way he would coerce me is he would text me while I was busy at work and say something like, I want to try partying with you this weekend. And I would ask him, what does that mean? What do you mean party with you? That's not something we even did. And he would say, well, I just want to try this one thing as an experiment, because if I just try to use or drink, or he would say, I want to drink with you this weekend, because if we have a drink together and if you're present there, then I can know if I can handle having a drink without going to use drugs. And he would say, that's actually going to help me stay sober in the long term if I can experiment with having one drink. But I need you to be there because I need to make sure I don't go off the rails. And he would tell me he was going to do this with me or without me. But if I was there, it would ensure that nothing bad would happen to him. So you see the manipulation. So that's how they justify things. It's like painted with a lot of, hey, this is why you're actually helping me. And if you don't do it, something bad could happen. So that led into a long time period of him getting me to go essentially buy drugs with him, which I didn't even realize was happening, because you start spending the weekend together and then he's like, all right, let's get in the car to go get food. And then he's like, oh, we have to stop somewhere. And before you know it, he's bringing drugs back to the car. Or just, it's crazy. But since it's the man that you also love and have good times with, you still don't think of it as, oh, I'm going to buy drugs right now. Wait a minute, we're in my vehicle. Wait a minute, if we got pulled over, I would get arrested. You're not thinking of it that way. It happens so, the slope is so slow that you're just like, well, he's just doing this thing and this will all blow over. Meanwhile, I could have gotten arrested.
Yeah. And another thing that you brought up that I love that you brought up is people look at women or people in abusive relationships and they think, how, why don't you leave? It's an abusive relationship. You're getting hurt. Why don't you leave? It's not always bad. It's not bad 24/7. There are good moments, and those good moments are the ones that keep you thinking it's possible. It's still possible. We still have good moments, so it's possible. The potential is still there, and those are the things that keep you from leaving. If it was bad all the time, it would be like, okay, this is a no-brainer. Even then, it would still be hard to get out of. I'm not saying it's easy, but it would be a little more clear. It's not as clear because there's good times.
And we were also going to church together, but he was constantly coercing me, like we constantly making me do things I was uncomfortable with. So it was like living a double life with him. And the big thing is, after an incident where he would coerce me into going to get drugs with him or other really severe things, that you can listen to my podcast, Why She Stayed. It's like the second and fourth episode is where I share my full story. But after any bad incident, he would wake up the morning and just act like nothing happened. Nothing big happened last night. He would ask me what I want for breakfast, tell me he's going to work. Like, that is a form of gaslighting, though. They don't have to outright say, "You're insane. You imagine that whole thing." If they wake up the next morning after something and they're just like, "Good morning, how's your day?" That is them diminishing what you experienced the night before. It makes you think it must have not been that bad if he's just acting business as usual today.
They often use the word "you're overreacting. You're being ridiculous. You're making this a bigger thing than it is." Well, because there's only you and him, you don't have an audience saying, "Actually, she's not overreacting." It's easy to believe. He's not as worked up about this. I guess it really wasn't that big of a deal. I guess I am overreacting, and you question yourself.
And it's also worth noting he had planted a lot of seeds in the beginning of our relationship about how many women he got. He used to live in Florida. He grew up there his whole life. And him and I met in Philadelphia. But he always made a point to say how easily he got women, how he would sleep with whoever. And that really built that atmosphere again of triangulation. Like, if I walk away from this, they're just going to be lining up around the block. People. Because he made himself seem like the prize. So at that young age, I wasn't able to see that as a turnoff. I actually saw it as the opposite, like, oh no, he's the best guy around. And so another thing he would do is he would always like mistreat me when we worked out together. He was a trainer, so he would promise me, "I'm gonna help you work out, I'm gonna teach you things," but then he would always mistreat me when we were at the gym. Like, for example, promising to help me with my workout that day, and then he would like get frustrated with me, and then he'd like storm off, and I'd be then having to work out by myself, which feeds into the triangulation. There's always other women in the gym, and one thing leads to another. Him making comments, "You need to gain weight, you need to gain weight," but I was always losing weight because I was so stressed with him. So it was hard. And I can remember this goes back to the drug problem too. He started pressuring me to take these substances. It's not a steroid. It's not like a like an actual steroid, but it's something you can buy online, but it's not like legal technically. And it just helps you really like take that next step, similar to a steroid. It's called SARMs. And he was pressuring me to take SARMs. And I remember saying, "No, I don't want to do that." Like, I absolutely did not want to. But he would then use that as proof to say that I'm too sensitive. I'm not willing to push myself in the gym. So I remember pretending like I was taking them. I actually bought them on this random website, ordered them, had to pretend like I was on these SARMs because he was always making me think like my body type wasn't enough. I needed to push harder. And so all of it is coercion.
This is why I love that you have your podcast. This is why I love that we're talking about this, because people don't see the progression. They don't see, like, why would you let someone tell you how to look? Why would you let someone tell you what to take? Why would you? It's so deep. It's so deep. And there's so much that has happened before that point that that's not that crazy. You know, at the time, you're just like, oh, just that? Okay. And I don't know. I think people don't understand it. Obviously, we always say, if you haven't lived it, you don't understand it. Well, you don't have to live it to understand it. You can hear enough stories. And that's one thing I love about your podcast is because I hear it all the time when guests come on your podcast and they say, I didn't realize I was in an abusive relationship until I listened to 3 or 4 episodes and they're talking about the things I'm living. And I didn't think those were abuse. I didn't know those things were abusive until I listened. And so this is why I love it. This is why I love talking about it so much more. So people can be very clear what's abuse, what's not abuse, and you know when they need to try to get out.
A quick note for people, back when all of this stuff was going on with the drug use, this was far before we were even engaged. So I was already at the point where I was like, I have got to leave this guy this time. This time has to be it right now. I was already at that point, like probably like 2 years before I married him. So that proves just how intense that cycle is, that I could go from being like, this has got to be the final time, to then 2 years later, we were married. And I don't want to scare anybody. There is a way that you can get out anytime that you're like, this has got to be at this time. But to make people feel less alone, it can take a long time.
Yeah. And it's a whole process. And I'm sure, you know, we'll get to that when that time came for you. But it's a whole process of setting yourself up to lead. It's not just especially not telling them you're leading and then leaving. It's, you know, in different situations, you have to be really careful about it.
So the glue that really held it together that whole time was, again, he was very, very good at apologizing, not only to me, but also to his parents, to his bosses. He had a way of perfectly mending things back together anytime he used drugs or mistreated me. His apologies were thorough, in depth, what was going to change, how it was going to change, why he was wrong, but yet I never considered abuse even then. So things that were happening while we were still dating is like he would accuse me of all kinds of things. He accused me of having Snapchat behind his back. And I like did have a Snapchat account, but I wasn't using it, but it was still active. So he would try to catch me in these random things that he thought I was lying about. And I remember I did start to lie about things because now at this point, he's already established with me, you're going to get in trouble for any little thing. So what does a victim do? We start lying about things. And then what does your abuser do? They say, see, you are a liar. So he would try to log into my Snapchat. He would FaceTime me on the spot and make me like show him my room to make sure nobody was in my room. But this would often happen when he was high, when he was using drugs. So it was always justified. Well, I'm only controlling of you like that when I'm high. And I started to form this correlation in my mind, like, well, maybe that's true. I really started to believe that. And so that still distracted from the fact that he was abusive by nature. I still couldn't prove that to myself. It was hard. And just getting mad at me for all sorts of little things. One time I didn't want to ride a roller coaster with him. We were like down the shore and I didn't want to ride a roller coaster with him. So he gave me the silent treatment the whole drive home. They will get mad at you for anything is my point. But it's through those little, that repetitive, anything can be misinterpreted by them. That is course of control. One time he got mad because he gave me flowers and I put them in this, I had like a ninja blender with no blade in it. So it's just like putting flowers in a bucket because I didn't have a vase with me. So I wanted to preserve them. I put them in that blender with water until I got a vase later that day. He got so mad at me for that. What kind of woman are you? You don't know how to be a woman because, you know, my mom knows how to take care of a house. He would always like compare me to his mom. You don't know how to like do things. And that would really hurt me because I'm like, maybe I don't know how to be a woman or maybe I'm just like not what he needs. I mean, he would attack anything.
Well, and you were so young. I mean, you didn't even know who you were at that point probably either. I mean, Any person can think back to when they were 20 years old and the decisions they were making, the things they were doing, and just how little they knew versus where they're at now. All do a lot of the same stuff that you're doing, but it's so easy for them to pick up on that and just, you know.
Yeah, the whole theme was every other woman in his life knew how to work out better than me, be a woman better than me, be intimate better than me. And I was always made to feel like I had all these improvements to make. So it became where I felt like the irony of it is I felt like I was in an addiction to him. I felt like I was the one who needed to be put away somewhere, or else feeling like I was never going to be able to break away from him if I didn't, like, literally go away. And that was really scary. So it's just ironic that he was the addict, and yet I actually became one too. But an interesting thing is during this time, I was still going to church by myself many Sundays, and I found this meeting at our church, the church I was going to. It was called The Way of Escape. And this meeting at our church was for loved ones of addicts. So I'm thinking, like, well, I'm a loved one of an addict. So I went to this meeting thinking, I'm going to pour myself into this to figure out how I can be a more supportive partner to him. And maybe just through going to this meeting, it will help strengthen our relationship. So I start going to The Way of Escape, thinking that I'm trying to defend my abuser more by going there. But really, in the background, I believe God sent me there to actually plan my eventual escape. Because when I started going to that meeting, that's what led me to the whole second half of my journey with my ex, which then led me to having a way of escape myself. So at this meeting, I found out about this program that was up in Maine, and it was a year-long program for addicts. And it was at a church, actually, but they have this really intense program where addicts can go and, like, get clean. They have a lot of success with it. But I thought, okay, I'm going to tell my abuser about this program. And he ended up agreeing to go because I told him about it during a time when he was relapsing. He was threatening to kill himself. And I thought, oh my gosh, I have the perfect solution. And now if he goes away to this program, maybe it'll give me a chance to get away from him because he'll be away somewhere. I don't have to worry about him threatening to kill himself. Like, this will be the best of both worlds. I'll get him off my hands, and then it'll give me time to, like, detox from him, and I'll be able to detach enough so that I can maybe leave. But before he went to the program, he made me promise to him, okay, but if I go, promise me that we can consider getting engaged if I do well in the program, and that we can consider getting married after. So I said, yes, we can consider that. Just go. Because I thought he wouldn't be allowed to contact me for, like, 3 months. So I'm thinking, okay, worst case, you know, let's say he does change at this program, then I'll see that he's changing. I'll be able to observe from a distance. But if he goes and he's not changing, I'll at least get space from him where I can break my addiction. Well, that's not what happened. He was allowed to write me letters right away. I mean, the very first week he went to the program, he was allowed to write to me. And for any young girl, getting letters from, like, the guy that you love, now you're really locked in.
That's old school, especially in our, you know, that's old school to be able to, it shows, and this goes back to when they have good moments. It shows the potential. It shows that there's something in there that's good. And look, they're showing me. They're showing me they care about me. They love me. And maybe now I can only imagine how confusing that was for you at the time, because he's getting clean and he still wants me. He's still writing to me. And
he was getting clean. And not only that, but he was now learning the language of manipulation. Now, the program, it is a good program, and they weren't intending to teach him language to manipulate me, but they were studying the Bible with the guys. It's a very intense program. So, like, he was actually learning how to better convince me that he was a changed man, like, at the core. So all it did was tie me in even further. And I think one of the things that actually convinced me the most that he was different is I was not only finding out information directly from him, like, hey, look how good I'm doing at my program. But I would always find out information like sideways from other people as to how good he was doing. So it made the change feel more real, because if I hadn't dug for that info on my own, like reached out to people, hey, how is he doing? What's the real deal? I would often get good feedback because he was very good at showing people that he was like just really serious about this. He was very good at portraying himself a certain way. And I think to a large degree, he also believed that about himself. Abusers often do truly want to believe that they are changing because it makes them feel justified to reap all the benefits from that. They feel like their life is finally realigning, but it's not going to be different. So because I would dig for info and just like verify things, I thought, well, there's no way it's not true then. So it was hard.
Because it's one thing for him to be saying, I'm doing amazing. I'm killing it. I'm changing. Look at me. Like, I can see the error of my ways. It's one thing to hear that from him. Because even then you can kind of be like, is this just talking? Is he just, you know, trying to keep me around? But then when you hear it from other people, you haven't had other people in your relationship before. And now other people are saying good things to you about him. And everyone in it, I don't care who you are, anyone in a relationship wants to hear other people saying good things about their partner. That's a good feeling. And so that had to just solidify it even more, or just confuse you even more.
It did. Another thing throughout the entire relationship, even back in the beginning, he would always write in notebooks. So he would write things in notebooks that he was learning in his class. He was taking a college course at the time. He would write things from church in his notebook. And then when he went to the program, he filled notebooks and notebooks and notebooks of just everything that he said was being revealed to him. And then he would send me those notebooks, or prior to when he went to his program, I would just like find them in his room. So since I would stumble upon things on my own, it always made him feel so legit, because I'm like, well, he's writing about things in a journal in his own time that he doesn't think I'm going to stumble upon. I took it out of his backpack. So I say that to other women, because people deal with this all the time. When they get info in this way, it makes their abuser seem like the real deal. But that can be the case. It can be the case. So, and it doesn't have any bearing on them actually being different.
And it's kind of a common theme, especially if you're dealing with someone who is, you know, has narcissistic personality disorder. Other people see a version of them. Well, I should say you see a version of them that other people don't see. They will never show that side to the masses. They will never show that side to everyone else. And so for a while, you might not even be believed what you're, you know, experiencing is real if you try to tell people, because they can't even picture it because they've never seen that side of him.
Yeah. So what happened after a while, we were communicating only through letters up until when I visited him for the first time at his program. And the only thing I would fault the program for was not noticing the giant red flag with our age gap. But I do credit a lot of that to how my ex was so, my friend and I call him Mr. the program name. Like, he was Mr. whatever. So that's the only thing I would fault them for, like that there was a big red flag there. And why was he trying to move this along so quickly? But I was allowed to visit him, and he proposed to me that weekend when we had only been communicating through letters up until that point. So that was a tactic to pose things as, hey, I just love you so much. I'm just so excited about this new chapter that let's just get engaged right now. It's no big deal. So that's perfect for an abuser, because they can craft the letters how they want and then spring an engagement upon you when you're not actually up close seeing them day to day. And at that point, my parents, of course, found out that we were engaged. They were already against us seeing each other. And we got in a huge fight because I would defend him to no end. I mean, I was willing to lose anything to this. I didn't care what I wrecked in its path. I felt like I had to protect what I finally had, because I thought this is finally where it needs to be, and they're just going to wreck it. Perfect setup for isolation. Now I think they're the ones that are ruining this, not the other way around. So when we got in a blowout fight, my mom said, you got to get out of our house, because I was still living with them at the time. So I moved in with my aunt and uncle, who were kind of on my side because my ex had really convinced them he was a good guy. And yeah, I moved in with them. It created a massive split in the family. And that was the next chapter.
And I think that's so perfect. Like, you stated it perfectly. That created the isolation. He didn't say, I don't want you talking to your parents anymore. I don't want you going over to your parents' house. He didn't have to do that. He did the, you know, thing where he isolated you just by you not wanting, you did it yourself. You isolated yourself because of him.
Exactly. In fact, he was posing as the peacemaker, like G, he would always call me G. G, I want us to be a big family. Like, G, I want us to all come together. But meanwhile, the pace that he was moving the relationship was actually what was splitting everyone apart. Because that was the big red flag everyone saw. Why are you guys getting engaged? Well, he's at this addiction program. So he was actually causing the split while saying, no, I'm the one that's for us all to get along. And what happened was my mom started going on the defense. Like, she mailed him a background check, like, letter. She wanted my ex to do, like, a background check, which that was totally the wrong move. Like, two things can be true at once. The parents can be going about it the wrong way because they don't realize that's going to further isolate you. But clearly, my ex was deserving of a background check. But that solidified the great split, because I was then just pointing the finger at them. You guys are crazy. Do not ever come near this relationship again, or I will never speak to you again. So that just made me cut them off even more. And we just kept getting closer and closer. My ex, he actually wanted me to marry him the day before he graduated his program. He wanted us to get married at his church up there, and he had everybody wrapped around his finger, the pastor.
And they thought this was a good idea.
Well, they eventually are the ones that told me, you're being abused, you need to leave him. But for a long time, it was kind of missed because they never had us together. They never knew us as a couple, and they only knew my ex as being Mr. Perfect in the program. So that's why we were allowed to do these things. And he had me marry him the day before he graduated the program because he wanted to solidify, I'm going to follow through on my promise. It honestly sounds like a story, but this is all real.
But I wanted to touch on what you said about your parents. They're doing what they feel needs to be done. They're worried about their daughter in this relationship. So they're doing, as parents, what a good parent would try to do in trying to protect their daughter. But one thing that I talk about when I am talking to someone who has a loved one in a relationship like this, the main thing that I say is, I know what you want is to pull them out of this relationship. You don't get to do that. That will not happen. It's just like addiction. It's just like drug addiction. You don't just go plop someone in rehab and all of a sudden they're clean. They have to want to get out. They have to want to get clean. You have to be steady and willing to stand by their side, set boundaries for sure, but be available when they're ready to leave. But you don't get to pull them out of the relationship. It does not work, because you're essentially just doing what he's doing. You are trying to control them now too. So they're just being controlled on both sides. So they're going to stick with the one that they're closer to right now. And that's the partner.
And I actually coach loved ones of abuse victims on a one-to-one basis. I do coaching with a lot of mothers who are trying to navigate. And I tell them, look, you can't just be a doormat. You can't have zero boundaries and just never hold your ground on anything. However, you cannot pull them out. There is nothing you can do to expedite this process. It has to run its full course to the very end. And then we work on how do you actually do that? It's really hard. But yeah, all that ever did was make me divide further from my parents and make me justify in my mind that they were the villain, because it was easier for me to paint them as the villain. because leaving my ex was such a painful thing that it honestly felt like death. It felt like it was going to be the biggest grief of my life, a grief I was never going to be able to get through. I thought that literally if I left him, I would never, ever get over it. And it was just a risk I wasn't willing to take.
Well, like you said, it's your day to day. He's part of your day to day. I mean, you know, anyone can think about losing a loved one. Well, if they're not part of your day to day, it can be slightly easier because it doesn't affect your day.
Exactly. So it led all the way up until the day I married him. And the night before we got married, his parents came to the wedding. My parents did not come to see us get married. We had like a very small gathering. And that was devastating to me. I was just like, what am I doing? I felt like I was in this alternate universe, like just so dissociated. I was not even there, honestly. I felt like I was just like a zombie. And I think I weighed like 96 pounds on my wedding day. I now weigh like 125. I was severely underweight from the stress. And the night before our wedding, I remember praying, God, if there is any possible way for me to get out of this, just rip it from me. Rip it from me now. Because I was terrified, but I still loved him. I was split down the middle, 50-50. I still wanted to be with him just as much. The night before our wedding, he got in a huge fight with his mom. He called her the C word. Called her the B word. Like, he got in a huge fight with her. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is my chance. Like, let me just say, I can't do this because I'm seeing who you are. Like, but I couldn't say it. It was like 10 o'clock at night, the night before our wedding. And I was sick with a cold. I had the worst cold ever. I'm like, this is not something severely wrong. But he was very good at making amends with her and everybody. So it blew over. I married him the next day. And right from the start of our honeymoon, it was bad right from the start. We went to the Dominican Republic for our honeymoon. And my ex, he speaks Spanish. I do not. So I feel like he used that against me because he was like abandoning me intermittently at the resort. He was acting pissed at me half the time. Silent treatment, doing his own thing. Yeah, he was like doing his own thing at the resort and I was like sitting places by myself. Lots of sexual coercion. You can hear the full story on my podcast again. But I remember him telling me, I want this to be a no phone trip. Like, now that we're a married couple, I need you to prove to me that you're leaving your parents and cleaving to me. So again, weaponizing scripture, taking it out of context. And I said, no, I want to be able to text my family. Like, we're in another country. I'm going to like give them updates. And he was so mad at me for that. You need to prove to me that we're one flesh now and blah, 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 blah. It's like.
I have to imagine he used at some point. I went through all those months of therapy to prove to you.
That was a big one that I forgot about. So now from this point forward, everything he used was that he had dedicated a whole year of his life to leave his job behind, do this program for a full year for us. He would say he was doing it for us. So he was training to be the man that I needed him to be and that he put all this effort in and I wasn't showing him that same devotion in return. That is manipulation. That is isolation. So he got me to delete my social media without directly saying you must delete your social media. Instead, I was now just trained where, well, if I'm on Instagram or TikTok, I'm going to be punished for that. So I deleted all social media. Anytime I went on my phone, anytime I picked up my phone to do anything, I just could feel his eyes on me. Like, what are you doing? Even if I was texting his mom, like, hey, how are you? I was accused of, well, who are you texting? Why are you always on your phone? Why are you always on it? So that's another thing. They're not going to outright tell you, you must not, whatever, fill in the blank. It's just now it's the standard.
Yeah, it's not blatant, it's not outright, because they can still claim to be a good person. They can still say, you know, if you say, well, you get mad whenever I'm on my phone, well, I just want us to spend more time together. I just want you to be focused on, you know, we should be focused on each other. And they can always twist. It's amazing how good they are with words.
It was the whole theme of the marriage. And I was only with him married for 6 months. We were technically married for a full year, but we were only together for 6 months married before we separated. The whole time it was that theme. Well, we're one. You need to show me that we're one. Why we need to spend, I forget what you just said. It was like some way they justify it.
We have to be focused on each
Focused on
other.
each
And
other. Yes, we need to focus on each other. We need to make the marriage work. So it's always them posing as the one who's for unity and reconciliation, but really it's to consume you with them. So until you look around and you don't have time for anyone else.
then you'll see on the flip side, when I see it a lot, when these women are trying to get out, realizing what this is, and especially if they have children, the abuser will usually say, "You're tearing the family apart. You're the one." They'll tell the kids, "Mom's destroying the family. Mom's tearing the family apart." No, dad did that with his behavior. That already happened. Mom's just making it official.
Exactly. And I can remember the first time I thought he was physical with me. We had just landed in the Dominican Republic for our honeymoon. He was pissed off at me. I mean, he was really mad at me for, again, the phone thing, all kinds of stuff. And he shoved me from behind in the airport. And I remember saying, "What, like, why did you just push me?" I was nearly in tears. He pushed me. But he said, "I was just trying to get you to walk faster." So that is how physical abuse starts. It's always followed up by them explaining it away. You just weren't walking fast enough. There were people around you, and I was trying to wake you up and get you to snap into it. That's what he told me. No, he pushed me because he was mad at me. That's the truth. So it was always very covert physical stuff, always framed as an accident, and it was always framed as being unintentional.
I want to talk about this because so many people think, unless he close fisted, you know, fist me, punch me, you know, then it's not abuse. And it's not physical abuse. And there are so many things that are physical abuse. Will you list some of the things that are physical abuse that some people would be like, oh, I didn't realize that constituted physical abuse?
Yeah, definitely throwing anything near you or around you, positioning themselves in any way that's intimidating, even if they're standing at a distance from you and you feel nervous for your physical safety, that's physical abuse. A lot of those actions, like them constantly having their hands on you, poking you, prodding you, pinching you, tickling you, like, and it sounds really strange, but they are desensitizing you to those physical trespasses. Blocking you in a room and not letting you out of the room. Another big one is kicking and hitting you while pretending to be asleep. That was one my ex would do a lot. He would kick me in bed when he was quote unquote asleep, let's say. But he was trying to get away with, but I started noticing it was always when he was pissed at me. So, that's a big one, kind of like elbowing you, but saying it's an accident. And then, of course, the sexual stuff that I talk about in my podcasts, they frame things as accidents, but they are doing things on purpose to you in that context. A lot of things like hitting you with a pillow, hitting you with soft objects, and telling you, what? It's a pillow, it's a soft object, fussing about it. Smacking you really hard in an inappropriate way, like on your backside. And when you say, "Oh, that really hurts," they're like, "What? I'm just being myself. Like, you can't take a joke." That's them. Because no healthy man does things like that. And then when you voice, like, oh, you hurt me, they're not going to then fuss with you about it and act like a toddler, you know? So let's see what else. Anytime they put their hands around your throat, unless it, you know, and I don't like when people even say it about it in the bedroom, because 99% of the time, it's not something that was explicitly even talked about. It's just them like doing that. So, anytime they put their hands around your throat, it's physical, and That's most of the examples.
There's also a lot of women who think, I'm drawing this line for myself. And if he does this, if he crosses this line, then I'll leave. Then I'll know. That would be my marker to leave. And half the time they do it and they stay because there's just so much more that goes into it. It's not that easy to be like, well, when he does that, I'll leave. But I think there are so many women out there who are thinking, I've heard women say, I wish he would just hit me. I wish he would just hit me because then I would know. Then I would be able to say it was physical abuse and I could leave and not feel like I was the wrong one for leaving, because they make you feel so guilty for wanting to leave this not great relationship.
It never feels like enough. But the way this ultimately ended up being my way of escape, remember I was going to that way of escape meeting, and that's how I found out about the program that he went to, which led me to move up to Maine with him and led me to all these new people I would meet. Many of the people at our church, and one girl in particular that I became best friends with, over time, people started telling me, hey, this is abuse. He's abusing you. You need to get away. Please leave, or else we're going to call your parents. Like, they were really starting to apply the pressure, threatening to out me to my family if I didn't start admitting that he was abusive. And our church tried to hold him accountable. They actually brought him back to the program several times, I think partially to try to give me some space from him. And I was in agreement with that. So as much was maybe handled poorly on the front end because of how he manipulated them, on the back end, I had a lot of support from them. And I don't believe they were going to let him back to the program at all. Like, they said he couldn't come back to church, so they held him accountable, which is rare. Most churches, they just like welcome the abuser back with open arms. And it's a topic I want to talk about a lot more moving forward in my work.
It's a tricky line. I think that you know, people in religious positions, it's because we teach forgiveness, right? We teach repentance and forgiveness and that people can change. But I do believe, I agree, there needs to be more awareness that there are some people who they are not going to change. It's just not going to happen. They don't intend to change. They don't want to change. And we have to take the behavior that they've shown seriously.
So not only did I have the cognitive dissonance of just being in abuse, but I also had the spiritual aspect of, does God want me to divorce this man? And so I became obsessed with trying to figure out if he had physically cheated on me, because I found all these transactions on his phone of sketchy things. And I was suspecting that he was physically cheating on me, but I could never prove it beyond 100% doubt. So I became obsessed with, like, did he physically cheat? That was like my version of, oh, I wish he would just hit me, was I wish he would just physically cheat. Because I thought then that would be clear spiritually, like, okay, I can leave him. But I was completely missing the fact that God would want us to leave our abuser. And I believe that's biblical. And I can go more into that on my podcast too. But even all the spiritual people around me, our pastor's wife, our pastor, my best friends at church, they were all together saying, yes, divorce him. Like, everybody was like, that is right. We don't care if he's cheated or not, because you need to flee from this. You need to run the opposite direction. So that became my fixation. It was really difficult.
So I know that you said on your podcast that you had a conversation with, you were working with a couple and the woman pulled you aside. Is that right?
Yeah. So there were multiple layers. I was getting a lot of support from people at our church, but my ex still at the same time would often pretend to be changed again. And then I would start lying to those people who were trying to tell me to leave. I would start lying to them. So then they would kind of just go along with it, like, oh, maybe they're fine now. A lot of people were not on the same page communication-wise, so we got recommended to go to these counselors outside of our church, not recommended by our pastor or our pastor's wife, just someone in our church recommended, hey, you should talk to this couple. They didn't know that that's the wrong thing. You don't go to couples counseling with your abuser. So we started going to this couple, and they were just approaching it like, okay, we're going to give you guys exercises to do at home so that you can learn how to better complement each other as a couple. So because they didn't know it was abuse, and I don't think they're trained on that at all, now I have homework to do where we're watching this videos on how to have a healthy marriage, like have sex more, be more, you know, he should be leading you kinder. He should be stepping up to the plate. Like, yes, those things are true, but it completely distracted from the fact that he wasn't going to be different. And those are actually the opposite things you should do if you're dealing with an abusive spouse. So then I thought, oh my gosh, well, if I don't at least try these things, how am I ever going to know? It felt like there was more unfinished business. Like, because he was the one who was like, let's do our homework. He was like thrilled about this because it, what did it do? It kept the hope alive and it was going to keep me in the marriage. Of course he wanted to stay together. So that was, that then led all the way up to when he got arrested, actually. So that was my saving grace moment, was the night of the arrest. And we were like thick into the counseling at that point. I had pretty much been like, I have no way out. Because at this point, I was so confused, spiritually, mentally, everything. So yeah, I was really deep into the confusion. And I remember I just started praying, like, I need a way out. I need something big to happen so that I can just break away from this. And sure enough, one night he did that thing again where he roped me into drinking with him. That hadn't happened in like a couple of years, probably. Remember, he used to do that when we were dating. And part of me was just like, fine, you want to be the leader of this relationship? You want me to be submissive to you? Blah, blah, blah. He always talked a big talk about like twisting everything. I said, okay, we'll do what you want to do tonight. So we got drinks. And again, he always made me feel like I was so part of this decision because I would technically do these things with him. But it was all just from, it was really hard not to. And so he drank that night. He ended up yelling at me for like over an hour. And I got 40 minutes of it on recording where he was just berating me verbally. Still never thinking like, oh, this is going to lead to the police being called. Never imagined that still. And I still was never even imagining like this would be my way out. I didn't even remember I had like prayed about that. So I still have that recording today, actually, of him yelling at me. And I would say maybe like 30 minutes after I stopped that recording, he just started getting scarier. Like he was just being more physically demeaning. And I remember he started intermittently grabbing me by the neck and like pressing me down on the couch. And that really scared me. Like, why are you grabbing me by the throat? Like, stop doing that. And he would, fine, I'll stop, whatever. But he did it like 3 or 4 times. And then he was telling me that I had to go stand against the wall in our house. And if I moved from that spot, that he was going to kick me. So now he's physically threatening me. You're going to get kicked if you move from where you're standing. And I was just frozen like, oh my God, I'm stuck here with him. And he's apparently going to kick me. And I remember he was making these kicking motions at me from the couch, like kick, kick, kick. Wouldn't let me walk past him to get my keys because I just wanted to leave the house without further incident. But then he jumped off the couch, launched himself at me, and he punched the wall with his hand right next to where my head was. He didn't punch me. He punched the wall, but that's physical abuse. And in that second, I bolted out the front door. The front door was like right where I was standing. So I bolted out and I didn't have shoes on. I didn't have a coat. We lived in Maine. It can get cold up there. So I didn't have my cell phone, my keys, shoes. I was wearing like the weirdest outfit I remember. And I ended up ringing our neighbor's doorbell. I didn't even know our neighbors. And I said, I need to come in. I need to come in. I need to come in your house. And they were like college kids. And I was just like, I think I need to call the police because I can't go back to my house. My ex is threatening me. He put his hands around my throat. And I ended up calling 911. And that was like the hardest moment ever.
Yeah. Because that's when you're bringing other people in. That's when you're officially telling on him. And you don't know, once it gets out of your hands that way, that's it. It's out of your hands, and you don't know where the police go with it, and you don't know what the repercussions are. Nobody in our, situation knows the law perfectly, so we don't know.
Yeah, so the police came and my ex stormed off in my car. He drove my car up this side of this embankment and he was wasted. He was drunk driving in my car now because I guess he knew I called the police somehow. I forget how it unfolded, but he vomited all over the interior of my car, everywhere, everywhere. I mean, the next day I had to get my car detailed. They had to take apart all my car parts to clean it. I'm sorry, but this is stuff they do. And he vomited all over the exterior out the window too. So when he came back, because he knew the police were gonna come look or something, he came back to the house. And when he was being questioned, he told them, "She threw up on me. She threw up all over the car." He was lying blatantly. And they weren't buying it at this point because they had already gotten my story. They could see right through it. They could tell he was lying and he had punched a hole in the wall. So it was the small details of my situation that made it clear to the police. And unfortunately, that is usually not the case because when the police get called, there's usually not a clear mark in the wall or a clear mark on the woman, or so it's very easily twisted. In my case, it just so happened to be that everything I told them was like laid out in front of them. So, but instantly I felt like I had told my best friend's secret. I felt like I just outed my best friend. And that same night, I was like, how am I going to put this back together? How am I going to get the charges lifted? He called me from jail like 3 times. Even though we already had a no contact order, he started breaking through it immediately and leaving me like, I don't even think he could leave a voicemail, but I was wrecked. I was probably in the thick of my addiction to him at that point because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm really going to try to put this back together with my own hands. Like, I would do anything at that point to get his charges removed. Thank God I couldn't.
Well, you've been trained all the way through this whole relationship that you once again caused the problem. Once again.
I blew it out of proportion.
Yeah. And you need to fix it. It's your responsibility to fix it now. This was just one more time that that happened.
I actually ended up driving back home to Philadelphia. I packed the car and left because I wanted him to be able to go back to the house, to be able to keep his job. I was already plotting, how am I going to put this back together and stay married to him? So from that day forward, literally the day after he was arrested, I was already planning how I was going to lie to my family, how I was going to cover for him. I started making phone calls to people at church. Oh, it's not what you think it is. It's not. And this is why people struggle when the police come too, because as a victim, you have that instant regret. Like, what did I just do? So you're more likely to be like, well, I don't really know what happened. You're likely to say that to the police too. And that's not me victim blaming at all. I'm just saying it's common behavior to want to cushion the abuser's fall because you're just so disheveled and you're blaming yourself.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I think most people hear the cops come and you're free. Finally, there's proof and you're free and you can go and you've been praying for a way out. This is why I'm loving that you're on and sharing this because you are the only one that can tell what goes on in the victim's brain. Because people who have not lived through it don't understand it. It doesn't make sense.
Exactly. If I didn't burn this to the ground where it was just ashes left, I would continue putting it back together. Like if the arrest didn't happen, I probably would still be with him. I'm not even kidding. So I did just that. I lied to everybody. I didn't tell my parents what happened. I was planning to go back to him and move back in with him a month later. I started breaking through the no contact order. I wrote him a letter explaining why this was all my fault and why we were going to have a beautiful marriage, why we were going to make this work. So I was stuck between praying for a way out, begging for a way out, but then every time I would have a way of escape, I would put it back together by my own accord. And eventually, once I got a little bit of time away from him, I just realized, like, if I go back again, we're going to get pregnant. We're going to have a baby, most likely, because he was very pressuring. We need to have a baby right now, because he wanted me to be further proved to him I was really in this. And that was really the turning point for me, where I said, this is the only time that I'm going to have a no contact order against him. This is the only time that this specific opportunity is going to present itself. And I said, you know what? I'm going to test him. So I said, hey, I know I broke through the no contact order, but it would really show me how changed of a man you are if you just respect your court order and do the right thing. But I knew he wasn't going to respect it. So I just used that to reignite like problems, essentially, by let me request a boundary. I know he's going to break that boundary because I know on a deep level he's still the same. So I had to kind of go back on like all my promises to him. And then sure enough, he kept breaking through the no contact order. And that was my aha moment. Like, this is my proof he's not different. I drew a boundary line. He does not respect it. So I had the courage to call the police on him again and say, he's breaking the no contact order. He got arrested again, went to jail. And that was it. That was the last time I talked to him at that point for like a year.
It's so crazy. And I love that you talked about setting a boundary, because that's what an expert will tell a woman in this relationship. If you're wondering if it's abusive, if you're wondering if it can get better or not, set a boundary. Just set a boundary. Just pick one. Set a boundary. You know, tomorrow night, I want to do my own thing. I want to go out with my friends, or I want to just stay at home by myself. See what they do. See if they can respect that boundary, because they usually can't. And that should be your first sign of like, okay, I'm not dealing with a healthy person.
Yeah. So what I want people to take from this story and how I ultimately escaped, which again, you can listen to my podcast. I go into more detail on that, but I had to be strategic. I had to let go of the guilty feeling about being strategic. I had to say, this is someone I have to be strategic with, and I am not going to feel bad for it anymore. So I had to actually reignite problems, because what I knew would happen, I knew he was going to be on his very best behavior until I was moved back in that house with him. That was the problem. Now that I'm away from him again, he knows this is his big chance to show me how good he is. He's going to just be on good behavior. And that was actually the most dangerous thing for me. So I had to reignite. I had to put him to the test while I was away from him. And that's how I cut it cold. I had him arrested, again, like I said. And then at that point, he knew he had to file the no contact, because he could see, oh, I actually call the police on him when he breaks this. So that's what got him to stop doing that.
I just keep hearing, like I said, I listen to your podcast, and you just hear of these stories more and more, which is what motivates me, and I know you, to get this information out more and more. And I would tell anyone, go follow Grace, go follow her Instagram, because she shares, everything will be in the show notes, so you can look for it there. But she shares some of the best stuff. And the thing that I love is that you've been there. You've lived through it. I can share it as an outsider of what I've learned. I haven't been there. So when you share stuff, I feel like it's even more powerful, because it's like, if she's saying this, then it's real. Then this is really how this happens and what it feels like as well. Because you talk a lot about how it feels to be in it and what you're thinking and in your thought process and everything. But I would encourage anyone, everyone to go listen to her podcast, honestly, to learn more about this. Number one, to keep yourself out of a relationship like this, but also to understand your loved ones who are in them and having a hard time getting out or seem to not want out, and how to support them as well.
Absolutely. Gosh, thank you so much, Bethany. Anybody listen to my podcast, reach out, and we're here to support you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate it, Grace.